where we are located, and who is in the room with us. I am Jerry Little, director of the Gopher. I am in the Gopher office at 1 Eagle Square, second floor in Concord, and I will ask the Gopher staff with me to introduce themselves as well.
Bob and Hensley.
Chris Dorian.
Sean Thomas.
Kate Spinner.
Yeah, Miss Smith.
Lisa English.
Thank you very much. The roll call, President Donna Tsuchi.
Donna Tsuchi here. I am home alone.
Okay. Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Steve Shurtleff, I'm at my residence in Penacook, and I'm here alone.
Leader Chuck Morse.
Chuck Morse, I'm here. I'm in my office in Atkinson, alone.
Leader Dick Hinch.
Dick Hinch here. I'm in my office in Merrimack, New Hampshire, alone.
Chairman Lou D'Alessandro.
I'm Lou D'Alessandro. I'm in my kitchen, and my wife is also with me.
Chairman Mary Jane Wallner.
Mary Jane Wallner. I'm in my home, Concord, and I am alone.
Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan, I'm in my office alone.
Representative Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron Hennessy, I'm in my home in Littleton. My two minor children are in the house, but not in the room at the time. Can I also ask, I'm hearing a lot of feedback and background noise. Are you able to mute people unless they raise their hand?
Yes, we are. We will we'll attempt to take care of that. We understand. So, and that's a reminder for folks, if you're not speaking at the moment, please put your phones on mute. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to first identify themselves in a similar manner before speaking. And should you decide that you need to take any roll calls today, roll calls will be done in this manner. Everyone should have received an agenda by now. If not, as mentioned, it is available on the governor's website. We're going to move right into our presentations. And the first segment of today's business is going to discuss issues that are being experienced by other government entities. Margaret Burns, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Municipal Association, are you on the phone with us?
Good morning. Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We hear you fine. Why don't you move right ahead with your presentation, and we'll let you introduce the folks that you've arranged.
Very good. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and thank you to Commissioner Little and members of the Advisory Board for inviting NHMA to present to you here this morning. With me is Barbara Reed, our Government Finance Advisor at NHMA, and we also have this morning giving presentations Mayor Craig, Mayor Donches, and Town Administrator Bill Herman. I also understand that Mayor Craig and Mayor Donches have some other municipal officials and department heads with them here this morning to go into a little more detail on some of the financial and other impacts that their cities are facing.
Very good.
NHMA, yes, go ahead.
When we get to, when you introduce Mayor Craig and Mayor Donches, we'll ask them to tell us who's in the room with them.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
NHMA is proud to call all 234 towns and cities in the state our members. As you can imagine, we have been deeply involved in advising our members as well as advocating for them during this crisis. And while there are many challenges municipalities are facing, the financial impact is now at the forefront. In anticipation of this presentation here this morning, NHMA launched a COVID-19 financial impact survey to our members on Tuesday morning, and we gave them only about 48 hours to compile a great deal of information relative to COVID-19 impact that included expenses, lost revenues, and sort of overall budget impacts and actions that towns and cities may need to take as a result of expenses and lost revenues due to COVID-19. Despite the short time frame for responding, 125 towns and cities responded to this survey, which was a 53% response rate. And really, this underscores what we already knew, that the financial impact of COVID-19 is of grave concern to towns and cities, and that financial assistance is critical. So this morning, Barbara and I want to give you an overview of those survey results. But before we do, I just want to provide a few caveats about the survey and about what it actually asked. The first is that our survey did not account for any reduction in state funding to municipalities, such as reductions in meals and rooms tax distribution, the $40 million in municipal aid, or highway block grant payments. All of our towns and cities, as you can imagine, are concerned and anxious about whether there will be cuts to those sources of funding. But when they reported on these expenses and revenue losses, that was not something that they specifically factored in this survey. The second caveat is that there are so many unknowns, especially to what the financial impact will be. What we do know is that the financial impacts will be long-term and significant. And while anticipated expenses and revenue could not be perfectly accurately predicted, municipalities have done their best to do so by taking into account things they anticipate will happen or looking at revenues they've already lost, expenses they've already incurred in trying to project what it will look like in the coming months. And finally, Barbara and I are going to give you only a high-level summary of what we received. We could spend all morning talking to you in detail about the information we received in this survey, but we will follow up with written materials to even better summarize in writing what the survey results are. So with that, I'm going to move into a summary on the expenses reported. And then Barbara will talk about revenue issues and revenue losses that municipalities are seeing and that they anticipate they will see. So for expenses, our survey looked at several different categories of potential expenses. We asked municipalities to do two things with regard to expenses: to report increased expenses due to COVID-19 from March 13th to date, and then to report anticipated increased expenses for the remainder of 2020 only. We did not go beyond that. Overall, increased costs to date, just for that five-week period starting on March 13th, were reported at $7.6 million by these 125 towns and cities that responded, and anticipated estimated future costs just for the remainder of this year are approximately $27.2 million. I'm sure it will also come as no surprise to you that towns and cities with police, fire, and/or emergency services reported significant cost increases in these areas, expenses like PPE, additional training, and overtime. Total spent to date in these categories was reported at over $2 million. With anticipated expenses for the remainder of 2020 at over $10 million for these categories. Now, I do understand from listening to Assistant Commissioner Plummer's presentation earlier this week, I believe, that many emergency response-related expenses will be reimbursed by FEMA, but there are many other categories of expenses that will not be reimbursed through that program that I just want to give you a look at here. For example, welfare expenses. 40% of the municipalities that took the survey reported they have already seen an increase in welfare expenses just since March 13th, and 53% reported they anticipate significant welfare cost increases. These are things like the more need for shelter and rental assistance, utility payments, and food. Many added they anticipate a huge spike in welfare need once the foreclosure stay is lifted. So looking even more long-term, what will the landscape look like when foreclosures can proceed. For example, the town of Conway has seen an increase in homeless clients and requests from individuals who have been laid off, particularly since they have so many retail and hospitality businesses in their town that have been shut down. And like many municipalities with a lack of shelters in the area, they're actually paying hotel room rates to house welfare recipients and to provide shelter in that manner. And they are not alone in being a community that's facing that and also facing a lack of shelters in which to house people. And so when we look at the aggregated welfare costs, the survey results showed that towns and cities anticipate an increase in welfare of about $1.6 million just for the remainder of the year. Another category that towns and cities reported on was technology. I'm sure you know and are aware that so many municipalities, maybe even all municipalities, to some extent have gone remote, some more than others, where town offices are closed down and everyone is working remote, and perhaps some services are just appointment only at the town hall. So technology costs have skyrocketed. 63% reported increased expenses related to technology, and more than half anticipate continued additional technology expenses, mostly for employees to work remotely, as well as for municipal officials to hold meetings and do other operations remotely, from everything from, you know, meeting software that's actually secure enough to hold meetings to digital signature software and things of that nature, so that municipal officials don't have to go into the town hall to do basic town operations, buying of additional laptops and other devices and things of that nature. Spent to date on technology, over $500,000, and they're reporting they anticipate about $850,000 more spent on technology for the remainder of the year. A really important and interesting cost that I think many of our towns and cities are going to face is with regard to borrowing costs. So many of the municipalities that took the survey reported they will need to consider tax anticipation note TANs this year due to a much higher than usual property tax payment delinquencies that they're anticipating. More people being delinquent, more people not paying property taxes this year than usual. Several towns and cities reported they haven't had a TAN in many years. Some reported they've never had a TAN, and those issues will make it even more challenging for them to access TANs. And of course, there are costs related to TANs. When you have to take out a TAN to carry yourself through, there are borrowing costs, including paying interest on money that you would normally receive through normal property tax payments. And Barbara is going to discuss a little bit more about TANs when she gets to the revenue portion of the survey results. Other increased costs that municipalities have and will face that were reported to us include legal fees. Many of the legal fees have to do with getting legal advice on employment issues and compliance with new federal legislation or compliance with CDC requirements for employees and other individuals coming into town offices. Anticipated increases in property tax abatements is a concern for municipalities. More individuals filing for property tax abatements based on inability to pay, and even commercial properties, unsurprisingly, because so many businesses are closed down, commercial properties looking for help as well. In fact, the town of Salem reported that they have about 30% of their tax base as commercial, and with all of those businesses closed down, normally having a tax base with a lot of commercial properties is a good thing, but with so many closed down, even those businesses are looking for relief and anticipating struggling to pay property tax bills. Other costs, increased costs for holding elections, increased employment-related costs, including unemployment, overtime. Towns and cities reported they've spent about $2 million on overtime to date, and they anticipate spending nearly $4 million for the remainder of the year. Other cost benefits for furloughed employees, loss of employees who are sick There have certainly been many towns and cities that have had individuals that have become sick or have become exposed to COVID-19 and have had to quarantine and be out of work. And also compliance with paying relative to new laws, such as the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. So the costs are significant. The anticipated costs are significant. And again, we've only looked out or asked them to look out until the end of 2020 to anticipate what those costs will look like. But the loss of revenues and the potential loss of revenues, what we've found both by talking to our members and through the results of the survey, are that loss of revenues is as concerning, if not more concerning, especially in the long term for towns and cities. And so if there are no questions at this time, I would like to turn it over to Barbara to talk about revenues and the concern for loss in revenues that we're hearing from our members.
Are there any questions for Margaret? Seeing or hearing none, we'll move to Ms. Reed. Barbara?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. As Margaret said, thank you very much for having NHMA here to express the concerns of our members. And as Margaret did indicate, that we did not specifically ask in our survey about the state aid, but I can absolutely assure you that it is of paramount concern with our members with the state aid. We did have some open-ended questions at the end of our survey, and many of them, small towns, large towns, cities, are very concerned about the state aid. The two other areas that I wanted to address regarding our municipal concerns about revenue, as Margaret indicated, the property tax delinquencies and the cash flow issue associated with that, and then get into some of the other revenue shortfalls that are raising concerns. So with the property tax delinquencies, I did just want to give you a little bit of background information on that. Of our 234 municipalities, 197 of them operate on a calendar year, the January through December year. 37 are on a fiscal year like the state, July 1st to June 30th. And most of the municipalities, a great majority of them, issue property tax bills twice a year. And those bills are due generally on July 1st and then generally on December 1st. For those municipalities, those 197 municipalities that operate on a calendar year, they have actually been providing municipal services since January, but they receive their property tax revenue in arrears because they bill 6 months into the year. So for many of them, this time of year is already a significant time for looking at their cash flow, and maybe times when they already are coming up against shortages, anticipating that July revenue. So certainly, with the concern about the delinquencies that may be coming, this is a significant concern. The other thing I did want to mention before I get into some of the details in our survey was that, as probably many of you know, most people who have mortgages are usually required by their mortgage company to escrow their property taxes. So basically, as they pay their monthly mortgage payments, they are paying monthly towards their property taxes. And generally what we have seen is once those mortgage escrow companies receive the property tax bills from the municipalities, they are very prompt in paying those. So that was one of the questions we also asked in our survey. So with that, when we asked the questions in the surveys, the first thing we asked was, of your property tax levy that's coming up this July, what percentage of your tax levy is generally paid for from escrow companies? Again, meaning people are escrowing their property taxes with their mortgage company. And it was a very broad range in the responses that we got from that. In some municipalities, it was as low as 15 or 16% of their property tax levy comes from mortgage escrow accounts. all the way up to a high of 75% or 80%. But the average was approximately 45% of the property tax levy comes from those mortgage escrow accounts. And again, I think there's an assumption there that mortgage payments are up to date, so the mortgage companies can make those property tax payments. The next question we asked was, what is your typical delinquency rate when a tax levy is issued? Again, there was a wide range, not quite as wide as the escrow range, but that range from a delinquency rate, and we define delinquency as meaning that the percentage of property taxes that are not paid by the due date. And that ranged from 2%, so 2% delinquency rate, to a high of 30%, with the average of about 9%. So an average of 9% delinquency on a tax issue. So then we asked under different scenarios, different delinquency scenarios, does your municipality have sufficient reserves that they would be able to continue municipal operations for the next 6 months under the following scenarios? If there was a 10% delinquency rate, a 20%, a 30%, or above 30%. With the 10% delinquency rate, almost all said that they could still maintain municipal operations if their delinquency rate was 10%. But again, remember, the average is about typically a 9%. When we asked if they could continue municipal operations, if the delinquency rate was 20%, about 40% of the respondents said no. They would not be able to maintain current municipal services. And when we asked if they had a 30% delinquency rate, 70% said no, they could not. And certainly anything over 30%, almost all of them, said they did not have sufficient reserves to maintain municipal operations. We then asked about their ability to secure a tax anticipation note. And as Margaret did mention, tax anticipation notes are just what the term says. It's a short-term borrowing in anticipation of receiving tax revenue that will be used to pay back that tax anticipation note. And as she indicated, many municipalities have not had to do that in the past. There is a requirement that there be statutory authorization. Municipalities have to go before their town meeting to get authorization to borrow money. We're hoping most have already done that. It's something that is only done once, and it's a provision that's good until rescinded. But the other thing I think that's important to recognize with tax anticipation notes is that what we're facing this time is sort of a different reason why tax anticipation notes are needed. As I mentioned, this is usually the time of year when cash flow runs short and municipalities would borrow for a few weeks or maybe a month or two. And once those July payments come in, they would use that money to pay back the tax anticipation notes. What we are looking at now is that there may be a significant delay in that tax revenue coming in to pay back those notes. So those notes may need to be held out for a much longer period of time than has typically occurred in the past. So when we did ask if they were able to obtain a tax anticipation note to meet their cash flow needs for the next six months, about a third of the respondents said they were not sure if that was available to them. What we are hearing is that some of the banks are willing to issue tax anticipation notes to their current clients, but not every bank issues tax anticipation notes. So if a municipality has a regular relationship with a bank that doesn't do TANs, there may not be an opportunity for them to secure a TAN from another bank. One of the other things I think is important to recognize, too, is that school districts do not have the authorization to issue tax anticipation notes, school districts rely on municipalities to pay over to them what they need to maintain their schools. And that is set by statute that the municipalities are required to pay to the school districts what the schools need to operate their schools. So it puts all of that cash flow burden, so to speak, on the municipality. And we are certainly getting a lot of inquiries from our members about whether they can hold off on some of the school payments or do something there. But there just isn't that opportunity for the schools to do short-term borrowing. It is all placed on the town to do that short-term borrowing, not just for their own municipal needs, but also to ensure that the schools are receiving the payments that they need. One thing I did want to bring up under this cash flow issue, just in case any of you hear something about this, we received a proposal information that came from the Federal Reserve Bank, that the Federal Reserve Bank is proposing to set up something called a municipal liquidity facility. It was a very brief outline of what this might be. We have not received much information about this, and at this time we are not sure if, when, or how this would even be available in New Hampshire, but it's a program that is being designed to specifically help with the cash flow needs of the nation's cities. It does specifically address cities with populations of over a million people, but there is some wording in it that looks like it could be available to others. The only reason I bring this up, again, it's called the Municipal Liquidity Facility, is that I'm just concerned that if you hear something about that, I don't want you to think that that will take care of all our needs here, because, again, we're not really sure if, how, or when New Hampshire could even participate in this. We have talked briefly to the Department of Revenue Administration and to the New Hampshire Municipal Bond Bank, and they only have the brief information that we have seen on that. But, again, that is just for your information as in case you see something about that. And just very quickly, I just wanted to mention a couple of other concerns about other municipal revenue shortfalls. Motor vehicle registration fees are generally the second largest general fund revenue source for most of our municipalities. A quarter of our respondents to the survey indicated that they are already seeing shortfalls in their motor vehicle registration fees. And this is despite the fact that the motor vehicle registration process is still in place. A lot of citizens are able to do it online. They're able to do it through Dropbox by appointment only. So that is an operation that is continuing, but we do have, as I said, about a quarter of our respondents said they are already seeing a decline in that, probably because this is not the time people are buying new cars. Families may not be registering as many cars in their family as they need. Business fleets may not be registering as many. And for those quarters of the respondents indicated that their projected shortfall would be about $23 million through the rest of the year. We also asked about utility payments. As you know, many of our municipalities provide water, sewer, and some do electric utilities. We did ask about delinquencies in those payments. A few did indicate they are starting to see delinquencies, but most indicated it's too soon to tell. A lot of those bills go out quarterly. And many of our respondents did say that they were hoping we would do this survey again in another month or two, where they would be able to provide more accurate projections. And finally, we did ask about, in general, other fees and taxes. And about almost 60% of the respondents indicated that they are seeing shortfalls in those other fees, obviously things like building permits and the, you know, sale of their beach passes, all their rec programs. It's just the whole variety of other fees and taxes. They are obviously seeing shortfalls and have projected significant reduction in those revenues for the rest of the year. And with that, I think Margaret and I are happy to answer any questions, or actually I'll turn it back over to Margaret for just some overall ending comments.
And Barbara, this is Jerry Little. Before you do that, I would like to remind the members of the advisory committee that when they wish to ask a question, if they would please push 5-star on their phone pad, that will let Rhonda know who has a question to ask. So that's 5-star for members of the advisory committee to ask questions in a moment. Margaret.
Yes, thank you very much. I don't want to take much more time because I want the remaining speakers to have plenty of time to speak. I just want to add that at the end of our survey, we asked sort of generally about overall budget impacts and actions that towns and cities may take to mitigate those impacts. And many reported that additional layoffs, additional furloughing of employees, cutting of public services, and drawing down their reserves entirely are likely actions that they will need to take. So I just want to add that, and we have more comments and more information that we can produce to you in writing afterwards. So I will just pause here in case there are questions or comments before introducing Mayor Craig.
We have a question from Representative Mary Jane Wallner.
Thank you. I think this is for Margaret. In your survey, did the cities and towns talk about the expenses and the upcoming elections in September and November, and how they're planning for those, and especially in this new environment?
Yes, thank you for that question. Yes, there was a question about election expenses, and municipalities did report additional expenses. To date, they reported $9,800 in expenses to date, and anticipated additional expenses for running elections through the remainder of the year of about $320,000. A lot of those expenses, and let me pull up this tab here on our survey. A lot of those expenses have to do with more absentee ballots, more printing, more, you know, staff needed in that area. But it also included PPE, disinfectant, additional staffing to make sure that things were being cleaned properly, to make sure people were socially distancing and things of that nature. So those were the majority of the costs they reported for elections, and certainly elections in general, not just costs, but their concern about conducting elections is still a concern. And we know that the memorandum from the Attorney General's office came out authorizing absentee ballot for voting for everyone, which is extremely helpful. But of course, it still means that municipalities need to have physical polling places, that there will need to be staff, that there will need to be cleaning, that they will probably need to wear face masks, and they will still have to conduct that physical polling place, which is still of concern for many municipalities.
Thank you.
We don't see any more questions. However, for the advisory committee, when you do want to ask a question, please just hit 5-star on your pad, and we will know that you're waiting. With that, Margaret, would you introduce your next speaker, please? And would the speaker tell us who's in the room with them?
Thank you. I would like to now introduce Mayor Joyce Craig as our next speaker.
Well, thank you, all of you, for the opportunity to speak, and I'll just start by letting you know who's with me.
Could I interrupt for one question? We do have a question. One moment. We have a question from Senate President Donna Soucy.
Thank you, Commissioner Little. Actually, my question was for either Margaret or Barbara Reed. Regarding the school districts and their ability to recoup any shortfalls, my understanding from what you said is that the school districts themselves cannot get TANs, but rather rely on payments directly from municipalities. Is there any other funding source for school districts facing shortages to obtain?
This is Barbara. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Thank you. School districts do not have statutory authority to do the short-term borrowing under tax anticipation notes. That was the point I was making. Obviously, there is a lot of some federal money in the CARES Act that is geared towards schools for their technology and distance learning and those kinds of things. But in terms of the property tax revenues that support the schools, that money, as you know, is assessed and collected by the municipalities and then paid over to the school districts. And by statute, it's as the school districts need to maintain the schools. So specifically to the property tax flowing to school districts, they don't have an ability to do short-term borrowing in the event that the delinquencies are 20-30%. Municipalities still must pay to the school districts. Does that clarify that response or that question?
Yes. So I guess I would just follow up, if I may. So there isn't another source other than that direct revenue payment for schools to make up the shortfall and do direct borrowing themselves, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly adequacy payments, the state could accelerate adequacy payments to the schools to help with the cash flow there, you know, with the schools. But, you know, the state is obviously going to be facing its own cash flow challenges too. So that would be another option that I could think of, but whether that's practical at this time, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Senator Susi, this is Jerry. Lisa English has joined our staff here at Gopher, and I think she has something to add to that question.
Yes, so thank you. There are some additional sources of funds that I can't...
I'm sorry, that was me.
There are some additional funds through the CARES Act that may be of assistance to schools, and I can't speak with any specificity right now, but certainly... there is the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, and I understand that New Hampshire is certainly getting some substantial funds for that. And that draws to sort of an additional bigger picture, which is we are trying to make sure we understand all of the different funding opportunities for all of the impacted municipalities, industries, and every part of our state. So this is all very helpful, and we're trying to connect all of the dots so that we're certain to leverage any funds that we're able to use to assist the state in the best manner possible.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Senator D'Alessandro, do you have a question, sir?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry. I was going to comment that there's $13.5 billion available in the elementary and secondary education portion of the CARES Act. How are we preparing to access that? Do the municipalities do it, or is that done through the Department of Education? What's the methodology that's in place to secure New Hampshire's portion of that money? Because it would mitigate costs here that I've heard mentioned as it relates to schools.
So this is Lisa English again. I believe there was an allocation specifically made to the state of New Hampshire, and we'll certainly look into the details with that. And the CARES Act specifies a number of ways in which the state educational agency can use that funding. And as I understand, I believe it's a pretty substantial amount of money, but I just want to make sure I understand what the funding is. And that is one mechanism that exists there. And, you know, there's some detail in the CARES Act, and for any of you that like to take a look at it, it's around page 756 going from there on if you want to look at some of the enumerated uses.
Great. Well, I appreciate that. And of course, we'll get our share, but specifically it would address some of the comments that were made by the Municipal Association about costs incurred having to do with the K through 12 situation.
Absolutely. We don't see any more questions right now at this moment. So, Mayor Craig, please accept my apologies for interrupting you previously. I truly apologize. Would you please go forward?
Sure, no problem. So with me, I have Bill Sanders, our finance director, and Shannon McLeod, who is the policy director for my office, and we are all in City Hall today. And I want to just thank all of you for the opportunity to share what we're encountering here in Manchester, and just say that Margaret and Barbara did a fantastic job really articulating the financial impacts and concerns that we have in Manchester as a result of COVID-19. So what I thought I'd do is just give you a quick overview of what we have been doing in the city, get into the finances and some of the other issues that we have. On March 2nd, we opened our Emergency Operations Center here in the city, focused on COVID-19 when the first positive case was identified. Very soon after, we were one of the first cities to open up a mobile testing unit, and that was done specifically to test individuals who did not have a general practitioner, but needed to get tested. We also implemented a hotline specific to Manchester residents so that we would take some of the strain off of 211. Again, that was initially for individuals who didn't have a doctor so that they could call and speak directly to a nurse to get consultation. It's now open to any resident in the city of Manchester to address any questions or concerns as it relates to COVID-19. And they can speak directly to a nurse Monday through Friday. We were the first community to set up an alternative care site at Southern New Hampshire University. I'm sure you've all heard about it. It's 250 beds to in preparation for surge. The hospitals were integral there as well as working with the state. Our EOC is active 7 days a week. It's comprised of our health department, fire department, police department, AMR, our schools, the hospitals, nonprofits here in the city. They work around the clock to anticipate and assess the needs and then meet the needs of our community at large. As of yesterday, we had 189 positive cases in Manchester. As a result of the governor's recent order, we are testing all congregate living facilities in the city, which includes all long-term care facilities as well as Fit New Horizons, the largest homeless shelter in the state. For every positive every positive test that is coming out of all of the testing that we're doing, our health department does a close contact identification, follows up with everyone so that they are self-quarantined, again, to stop the curve of COVID-19 as best we can. From a budget perspective, as both Margaret and Barbara talked about, there are significant budget shortfalls from a revenue perspective, and we have increased our spending. From March 13th to the end of the year, we're anticipating about a $25 million revenue shortfall as a result of delayed tax payments, lack of parking revenue, lack of rental, which would include our baseball stadium, the Dairy Field, McIntyre Ski Resort, and we are also, I think it's important to note, concerned about the rooms and meals tax and how that is going to affect our city. So typically, we will get between $5.4 and $5.5 million in a normal year, and we're anticipating that we could lose between $1 to $2 million. We just don't know what that impact is going to be. For the city of Manchester, those revenues go directly to the SNU arena. So that's a big question and concern from our perspective. This also is going to affect our valuations in the city. And, again, looking at estimates, it could be a loss of between $2 and $5 million from that. To give you a couple specifics, our fire department has been spending about $150,000 in overtime per month. Our health department to date has spent about $200,000 between overtime and PPE supplies since this started, and we're seeing, losses in revenues at Waterworks, the clerk's office, and parking and library and so forth. In addition, the impacts of COVID-19 are affecting our local businesses and restaurants. So from an economic perspective, two of the largest employers, CMC and Elliott, have furloughed hundreds of employees. Our small business, many, many of our small businesses are closed. Cash flow is a huge issue for them. As I believe was stated earlier, you know, we're hearing a lot of frustration from the lack of federal funds or the not being able to access them. So as a stopgap, we have implemented a small business loan program in Manchester that once the stay-at-home order is lifted, we'll be able to help about 40 small businesses in the city who are in good financial standing prior to COVID, but have been affected from a business perspective as a result of, you know, one of the biggest issues that we're all facing is we just don't know when this is going to end. So as we all understand that we need to stay home to ensure the safety of everybody, but we're hearing a lot of concern and complaints from our small businesses. They want to open and get back to business. This is also playing out significantly in the homeless population here in the city. We actually had our EOC opened back in March and working on addressing the homeless situation, mental health, and addiction. The state had been working with us there as well as many of our partners and nonprofits here in the city. We did transition over to COVID when we needed to. But having the largest homeless population, the largest shelter in the city, they are one of the most vulnerable populations. So it's been a very, very challenging situation. Again, we've had a lot of conversations with the state on how to best address this. But the reality is there are about 138 people per night in a shelter, and they're too close to each other. So our shelter has done a lot of work in securing another space to be able to separate the population. But when and that was supposed to happen on Tuesday, but since now we're testing all of the employees and all of the residents of the shelter, we need to wait and find the results of those tests, and we'll be able to move the healthy into another area. One of our critical needs here in the city is an area for individuals who are homeless who have tested positive and an area for individuals who are homeless who are awaiting test results. We've heard that the state is setting that up, but to date there's not anything. So we're really concerned for the safety of individuals at the shelter as well as individuals in our community. And so, you know, if there's anything this group can do to help in getting that going quicker, it would be tremendously, we would really appreciate it. We expect the need for significant resources for staffing these additional facilities as well. Appreciate the governor's suggestion to pay the $300 for individuals working at long-term care, and if there's anything that we can do to assist with getting that done at the homeless shelters, it would be very helpful. As you can imagine, typically they rely on volunteers to help, and that volunteer supply has really dwindled away because of the vulnerable population. And so we are in desperate need of individuals to help us there. Mm-hmm. So this is one example of a situation where the costs are significantly hitting our city. We do anticipate seeing an increase in needs in addition to homelessness, domestic violence, mental health services, food insecurity, an increase in poverty. And so we're trying to adjust and anticipate how we address those once we come out of this COVID-19 crisis. And then in terms of schools, they are anticipating about a $4.6 million potential expenditure necessary to get through this pandemic. It ranges from everything from food services to additional nurse and resource offerings to, you know, being able to provide the online services that we need, summer learning opportunities, because we know so many of our kids are going to need that. Right now we're delivering 7,000 meals per weekend to our students. And we're going to need to continue to do something like that even when the school year is over. I think anything else that you...
It's up to you.
This is Bill Sanders, the finance director for the city. Just very briefly, I'll probably just reiterate a couple things the mayor brought up, but the impact of abatements is unclear to us as to how this is going to play out, but we are expecting requests for tax abatements from various property owners in the city. That's a difficult number to estimate, but it could be the abatement itself could result in a couple of $1 million at a minimum in that area. I would mention that. We obviously are going through evaluation that is dated as of April 1, which is the day this whole virus began. This could have a significant effect on the assessed values that we'll be looking at and would have a definite requirement to increase our tax rate. But that is an unknowable right now and probably won't be known until sometime in October, but very critical to us. The rooms and meals tax that the mayor mentioned is very important to the city, and we're anticipating that could be under some pressure at the moment because of the lack of businesses operating out there in hotels and restaurants. Already getting calls from the rating agency, Moody's specifically, that would like to have a meeting probably next week, a phone call to talk about rooms and meals, and not really I'm a little in the dark on where we're headed there as a state. I can make some comments to them, but I could be somewhat short on answers at the moment. I'm hopeful that there'll be some ability in this funding programs that you're dealing with to maybe bring at least hold the rooms and meals steady for all the communities across the state of New Hampshire. It's been talked about the permit activity in the city for new building activities. It's been very solid up through March, but we're having issues beginning here in the month of April, and likelihood next year what we were contemplating in our original budget proposal for permits could be at some risk, as well as auto registrations, and that's already been mentioned. I'd also note that the parking division of the city is a very important revenue contributor to the city. On a net basis, after expenses, the parking division probably generates about $3.5 million of a dividend, if I can use that word, to the general fund of the city each year. Each month that we're in this shelter-in-place situation and businesses are closed, we're losing about $400,000 of that. So over a two-month period, it's about $800,000, and that will hurt our budget this very year if this continues. I realize that's not in the committee's purview to decide when it should end, but that's a significant risk relative to parking. So I just wanted to mention those few items. They're none of them good, and we're managing it. We're not seeing deficits at this point at all for this fiscal year, but you'll be challenged to cover some revenue shortfalls if they all go south together. Thank you.
And do you have anybody else for us, Mayor Craig?
Nope, that's it.
Very good. Well, then I think that's back to you, Margaret Burns from the Municipal Association. And a reminder for anybody that has on the advisory committee that has a question for us, please hit 5-star on your keypad. Margaret, your next speaker.
Yes, thank you. Our next speaker is Mayor Donchett from the City of Nashua, and I know that the city has several other municipal officials and employees with them this morning to talk about the financial impacts on their city.
Please hit 5-star to speak.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Well, this is Jim Donchess, the mayor down in Nashua, and I first want to thank all of you, certainly Commissioner and the members of the committee for entertaining our comments and our thoughts about how this could affect municipalities. and certainly to the Municipal Association, Barbara and Margaret, for putting this opportunity together. I would like to emphasize, as I think Joyce did as well, that our thinking on this is very preliminary. We were asked to put this together in 48 hours, and I understand the desire for the short turnaround. But just even hearing the comments by the Municipal Association and by Mayor Craig, it helps to deepen at least my thinking about how this could affect us and how much our revenues and could be reduced and how much the expenses could be increased. So as we go forward, I think it would be helpful if we were to revise all of these figures, try to give you something more specific. But this certainly is our first pass. Joyce and I talked about our presentations, and I don't want to repeat everything that she has said because I'd like to give you some more information. But Nashua has taken most all of the same steps as Manchester has to combat the COVID-19 crisis. We have the EEOC. We have the hotline. We've set up an alternative care site. We have we've proposed the small business loans and impact fund for our nonprofits. We've done the meal delivery, delivering thousands of meals every week. That's been very important for our kids. We have 115 positive cases. Now, in terms, and those are being tracked, and I will spend a moment speaking about that. At this point, I wanted to let you know that we do have two other people on the line. One is Bobby Bagley, who's the Director of Public Health and Community Services, and Justin Cates, who's the Emergency Management Director for the city. We too, like Manchester, are going to see significant revenue losses, and Mayor Craig estimated a $25 million loss of revenue potentially. I think that is definitely realistic. Like Salem, like Manchester, Nashua has a commercial tax base, and we expect, but we don't really know what's going to happen with respect to abatement requests. I know that the city's largest taxpayer, which is a mall in the south end of Nashua, submitted an informal request for a 20% abatement by letter. I don't know even the legal status of that, but we can expect that in the months to come, we're going to be seeing considerable abatement requests. I don't know how those will play out, but they represent a very significant potential loss of revenue. Also, we could face the loss of rooms and meals tax, the automobile registrations, which in our case, I think are around $17 million. That could go down. The parking revenues, all of those same revenue losses we could experience. And we collect more than $200 million a year in property taxes. So even a 10% reduction in assessments or in revenue, I mean, you can translate that. 10% would be $20 million. I wanted to add to Mayor Craig's comments in talking about some of the expenses that I believe may be necessary for us to undertake for both communities. First of all, we operate regional health offices, health departments. We receive state grants. Both departments receive significant local money, but also state grants. And both departments function as regional health agencies. So their scope, their services extend beyond the municipal borders. In our case, into the region around Nashua. And, of course, we are surrounded by other larger towns. In our case, Hudson, Merrimack, Manchester has the same thing, I think, with Bedford and some of the other towns. And we are thinking about how to address the COVID-19 crisis and how to try to box it in the months ahead. Now, we know that because we want the whole region to be safe, and, of course, this virus does not think in terms of municipal borders. We are on the border of Massachusetts, and although we in Nashua and Manchester is the same, we have a relatively small amount of cases right now. As I said, Nashua is 115. I think Joy said Manchester is 189. We know that the hospitals in Lowell and Lawrence are on the edge of being overwhelmed. I mean, they have a lot of patients. They have a lot of people on ventilators. Now, I don't believe that has not happened in Nashua yet, but we're trying to prevent it from happening. But we are very close to an area where the impact has been much, much more severe than we have seen so far in southern New Hampshire. But our goal is to box in this virus and to keep New Hampshire in a safer state than we see in some of these cities in northern Massachusetts near the border of our state. So looking forward, I mean, we mayors have a periodic conference call with Governor Sununu regarding the coronavirus situation, and we talked through various issues. And yesterday, the governor was very clearly indicating that they are doing everything they possibly can to secure the availability of tests. He's trying to work of testing. And I think he made it very clear that he believes, and he's right about this, that we need much more broad-based testing in order to open the economy in any kind of way that it will provide confidence that people won't walk out the first day and get COVID-19. In any event, I think that the state will be over time. Providing the testing, or will be providing the municipalities and themselves and medical providers with much broader testing results. Now, some of that cost may be, in my thinking, of course, this is all preliminary. It's best if this were done regionally, in the sense that Nashua could be involved in testing, Nashua Health supervising and helping with the testing in our entire region. So the cost of those tests has to be thought about, and we did put something about that in our survey. Some of that or all of it may be borne by the state, but it could fall on the municipalities depending upon how we the state decide to address this. But in addition to the testing, the next step that has to be done in order to box in the virus is extensive tracking of each positive case each person who has tested positive in order to identify all of their contacts and then work with those contacts on quarantining and other things so that they in turn do not spread the virus. That tracking can be, and that is going on right now. In Nashua, we have all of our public health nurses working on that, and we're now tracking 90 or 100 different contacts of the remaining active cases that we have. I assume Manchester is doing the same thing, but there's been very, very limited testing so far, and the number of cases, although certainly smaller than it could be, is growing, and it may grow much more significantly in terms of the numbers when more extensive testing is available. So we need to be prepared if we want to keep the virus boxed in and as under control as much as we can to be able to track all these individuals, all of the contacts of every case. And that may involve, I mean, we have 6 public health nurses. They can do, you know, quite a bit. We've engaged some of the school nurses who could do some more, but if we end up, and I only know the number for Nashua. I don't know Merrimack, Hudson. I don't know the region. They don't provide the information town by town like that. But, you know, if we are watching these 115 cases we've had and the remaining positives that they're still active. But this should be done in the entire region, and as testing expands, the number of cases will go up. So we really need to have teams of these trackers to follow the contacts of the people. So I think I've gone on that. I think you understand what I'm talking about. But that is could be a significant expense if we want to make sure that we limit the virus's spread as much as possible. The other area that I wanted to address, in addition to all of the issues that Mayor Craig did, which the loss of revenue, are the issues with our homeless population and the like, is the educational losses that are going to result as a result of basically 6 months away from school. So right now, as you all know, we're doing our best, teachers, administrators, school departments, to conduct remote learning. And that involves really the parents. And many parents are doing a good job, as good as they can. But there is no way that across the population of our students that all are getting the same level of education in this remote learning environment as they would if they were attending active regular classes. I mean, think of a first or a second grader who's trying to, or a third, and we're trying to get the third graders up to a third grade reading and math level. How are they learning to read and do basic math over the internet? There was a study that just came out talking about this. The amount of loss by trying to do internet learning is significant, and also there are some families where there's no remote learning going on or not much at all. Our superintendent has said that some kids are quote off the grid. I mean, they may not have internet. Maybe their parents are working. Who knows? So they're over the 6 months where kids are getting partial or partial or virtually no education from like March through September, when we hope the schools can open, there's going to be significant loss. And we already know that among the free and reduced lunch population especially, but other kids as well, they're already... Many kids are already performing below grade level. And if they're already doing that and they have 6 months off without much exposure to reading or math, they're going to be way behind. And even kids who are at grade level could fall back. So we need to have, in order to avoid impacting these kids for lifelong, we need to have, I'm saying, an intensive remediation tutoring effort and this might extend beyond the end of the year, but an extensive effort to bring them back up to where they were before or and advance them as much as we can in order to offset the effect of the 6 month hiatus. In any event, I've gone on quite a bit. I think you, so I'm concerned about the revenue. In summary, the revenue loss, we need to be aggressive in terms of testing and tracking. That should be, money should go to that, significant money. Again, that could be done regionally. we would, you know, a lot of people from Merrimack work in Nashua, vice versa. I mean, this is not a municipal boundary type of issue. And so that's an expense. And, of course, the school issue is an expense. But unless you have questions, I will turn it over to Bobby Bagley, who is the Director of Public Health and Community Services and has been doing a great job in leading the city's healthcare response to the COVID-19. And then to Justin Cates, who has been responsible for setting up the alternative care site, responsible for directing our efforts to close City Hall and work remotely, everything that we're doing. So
thank you, Frank.
I will turn it over to Bobby Bagley.
Thank you very much, Mayor Donches. This is Jerry Little. We are quite a bit over the time segment that we had set aside for the municipal presentation, Margaret. And so, Mayor, if you would ask your staff to bullet point their presentations for us, that would be greatly appreciated.
Okay. Could you please bullet point your presentation? So you're telling me I went on too long. Well, yes, I probably did, but we're worried. Anyway, so... But again, I appreciate the committee indulging us at all. So, Bobby, could you go ahead?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Yes. This is Bobby Bagley, Director for the Division of Public Health and Community Services. I'm in Londonderry in my home, and I'm alone in a private space. I don't have much more to add than what the mayor has already talked about with regards to our response in Nashua, other than to say that we've had, just as the mayor said, we have our staff working 7 days a week. Our hotline is open from 8 to 9 p.m., 7 days a week as well. We do have a significant amount of hours that are being put in response to COVID-19, and I would just add on to, you know, the thought of the conversation is that life still goes on for all of the individuals in all of our communities. And so there are other things that also need to be addressed and taken into consideration. The mayor talked about the school and what's happening at homes with parents. We have to also remember the adverse childhood experiences that families are experiencing as well, increased isolation, depression, possible increased child abuse and domestic violence that is not being captured right now because individuals are not able to use those services. And so as we come over the hump of this wave, there will be a significant amount of work that will need to be done by all of the partners that are involved in this systematic approach that we've taken very proactively to keep our community's health intact and resiliency and just really put an emphasis on the strength of what's going to be needed for our public health infrastructure as we continue to go through this over the next 6 to 8 months and the impact that that's going to have on our cities as a whole. So the mayor's talked about the financial pieces of that, and I just wanted to emphasize that ongoing public health response will need to be strengthened in order for us to maintain what we want for our city's health and well-being. And I'll turn it over to Justin and entertain any questions as a result of those comments.
We see no questions right now. Justin, go ahead.
Perfect. Do you hear me okay?
We hear you fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. Justin Cates, Director of Emergency Management for the City of Nashua. I think many of the points around our cost to date as well as our future costs concerns have already been brought up by the New Hampshire Municipal Association, the City of Manchester, as well as by Mayor Donches. But I did want to just bring up two considerations that I think are important to consider for municipal operations as we move forward through the recovery of this incident. One of the reasons that Manchester and Nashua were really able to react so quickly to this crisis and to develop the responses that were described by Mayor Craig and Donches was because they have strong local public health and emergency management programs. and Nashua has had a dedicated Office of Emergency Management for the last 9 years, focused really around planning for an incident just like this. And while FEMA and U.S. Health and Human Services provides funding through New Hampshire Homeland Security and Emergency Management and New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services to support preparedness through training, equipment, supplies, exercises, this is typically not significant enough to support the staffing and operations for a robust emergency management program at the local level. And future preparedness investment needs to really be considered in the recovery of this incident, especially when there's such great attention to this topic by public and as well as our elected officials. And I think the second point to consider as part of the recovery here is we've planned for long-term recovery in the city of Nashua with a lens of resilience over the last few years as part of our Resilient Nashua initiative. And one of the recommendations that came out of that initiative last year was to consider ways to build back better after a disaster. And there are opportunities to change the way that we provide services in municipal government. Thought should really be provided on how funding may be able to be put into local communities to innovate and provide lean digital services to our constituents. And supporting intuitive online services and secure IT systems may really help to reduce the personal protective equipment and physical modifications that we're looking at making to our facilities in the coming months, which all come with a very significant cost. And planning with that lens in mind really enables the opportunity for us to come out of this stronger and more nimble to handle future public health emergencies, as well as other disasters that impact our physical operations. So I just wanted to add those two things. I think they do relate to recovery, and I think they should be considered as we look to support the municipalities across the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the advisory committee for members for Mayor Donches or his staff? Seeing none, Margaret, I believe your next speaker is Town Administrator Bill Herman.
Yes, and thank you.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say thank you, Jerry, and members of the committee for indulging us past our time frame. We just have one more speaker, Bill Herman from the Town of Auburn.
Hello, can you hear me?
We hear you fine, Bill.
Thanks. Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it. And although I think I had a stellar 30-minute presentation for you, I'll try to just give you some bullet points, and I'll provide the written material to Margaret to supply to the details to you. My name is Bill Herman. I'm the town administrator for the town of Auburn. I am in my municipal office alone, and I do appreciate the ability to be here today to talk on behalf of New Hampshire's town government. As all of you know, New Hampshire is a state of small communities, and individually our numbers may be small, but collectively they do add up to substantial amounts. For those that don't know, Auburn is in southern New Hampshire. It's a town of about 5,400 residents, and we share common borders with the city of Manchester and the towns of Derry and Londonderry, among others. One piece I'd like to highlight that Auburn has specifically been affected is that as of this week, we have experienced a total of 4 employees who have been in quarantine due to COVID. And that may sound like a small number, but those 4 employees to us represents 10% of our municipal workforce of full and part-time employees, not including our roster of call firefighters. The quarantine has affected the police department, our library, parks and recreation, and town hall. Thankfully, at this point, all have been cleared and are able to return to service. I would just note none of their issues were the result of work-related exposures. They were either family or travel issues. Very quickly, known financial issues for us at this point focus on the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We have paid out approximately $12,000 in wages and benefits under the requirements of this federal legislation. Although it represents about 1% of Auburn's total payroll, the vast majority of this expense has been for our library, and it represents 7.5% of the library's payroll. In the area of law enforcement during the months of April and what's anticipated for May, there's been shift coverage expenses and other expenses for equipment, supplies, and training costs. that we anticipate will be about $7,400. In the fire department, for COVID costs, establishing PPE kits for all vehicles, new operating protocols, and also running training with the police, they've experienced about $1,500. We expect these types of costs to continue for as long as there is a stay-at-home order or state of emergency remaining in place beyond the month of May. In the town hall, we have had to take some steps for, frankly, protection of our employees, things like putting in plexiglass shields in customer service windows and installing a drop box at the front door to limit traffic through the building. Those costs have come to about $1,500. Annual assessing is an issue for us. Our field work had to stop in mid-March. It is hoped that it can be resumed by May 5th. But we need to have that work completed by May 20th in order to be able to issue first issue tax bills by June 1st with a July 1st due date. What we're most likely looking at is issuing first issue bills without that values, without those additional properties, and then needing to do a supplemental tax warrant and issue up tax bills for that added value for the new homes and new construction at some later date, whether it's July or when we are able to do it. That additional warrant and billing would be most likely about another $1,000 expense. Our library is attempting to address the stay-at-home nature of current conditions. They're moving to more digital and online resources and materials to be available to their patrons, but there's a cost to that, an added cost of about $1,500 a month or maybe $9,000 through the remainder of this year. And they also are doing some things of adding plexiglass, increasing frequency of cleanings and the sort that will likely cost them about $2,600. And the last area for us of known expenses or revenue loss is in the area of recreation. We have canceled virtually all programs in April and May and now for part of June. And while many of these cancellations save us some money, it also means there's fees that we are not collecting, and that the net is a loss for us in revenue of about $2,500. So for Auburn, it may be a small number, but we think we have already experienced about $37,500 in COVID expenses. Like you've heard from all of the prior speakers, the real impacts, we believe, are coming forward, and they're guesses and estimates on all of our parts at this point. I'll just say the three main areas that Auburn itself is looking at. One is the area of public assistance. And as we rebound and whenever we are able to come out of the stay-at-home order and the state of emergency orders number three and four that concern the moratorium on evictions, foreclosures, and the shutting off of utilities will run their course. And we anticipate that municipalities like Auburn will see an increase in applications for public assistance, as we are the stop of last resort. Looking back at the last time there was an economic downturn in 2008 and 2009, Auburn anticipates potentially 20,000 or more in unanticipated and unbudgeted expenses in this area. You've heard very eloquently from all the prior speakers, but depleted cash flow and the potential cost of a tax anticipation note is something we are very concerned about. Auburn currently has adequate cash flow to meet its financial obligations through the month of or into the month of July. And if we're able to get our first issue bills out by June 1st, and assuming they are paid by July 1st, we're going to be in reasonably good financial shape. But if either of those two things don't happen, we will need to look at borrowing money in the form of a TAN. In Auburn's case, we have not had to do that in more than 20 years. And whatever it may be, it's clearly going to cost us more than the budget amount of $1 that is currently in the town's operating budget for the borrowing of TANs. Our best estimate at this point, if we have to borrow a TAN, is that it will likely cost us between $30,000 and $40,000 in unanticipated expenses. The last area of concern for us is the potential reduction in state revenues, and we fully understand that state revenues are not what they were anticipated when the budget was put together. We anticipate that revenues these revenues will be reduced either because the state has brought in less money and will have less money to share, or frankly, the municipal payments may be a very much needed part of whatever budget adjustments are made in the future by the governor and the legislature. For our purposes, we're anticipating a potential reduction of 30% in this area. In real numbers for Auburn, that means a highway block grant, we could see less. We'll see about a $50,000 reduction for meals and rooms. It's $85,000. And potentially the municipal aid revenue is $43,000. So for us, that's $178,000. All combined with the identified expenses I mentioned earlier, I think we're looking at the potential of a $265,000 to $275,000 shortfall, which represents 5% of our approved operating budget. Because municipalities operate on a gross budgeting basis, any added expenses or any losses in revenue ultimately have the same effect on our property taxpayers. They both lead to an increased property tax rate. And I just want to acknowledge, I'm happy to be here representing small towns and to tell at least quickly a piece about Auburn. But I think, again, as all of you know, no two communities are exactly the same. And Auburn's experiences and potential costs or loss may not fully represent what other communities are experiencing. Auburn, for example, is an SB2 community who has been able to complete all of its annual voting and business processes prior to the declared state of emergency. But most traditional town meeting communities or those with an April or May town meeting have not. Auburn does not have a municipally owned and operated solid waste facility, water systems, or wastewater systems, but many do. Auburn also does not have a staffed highway department, but rather we contract out all of our work efforts. And I just point out these basic differences only to suggest each municipality is going to have different impacts than those that I have outlined for Auburn. The one area where I believe, and I think all of the prior speakers have said, all municipalities are going to have difficulties is in experiencing financial, in the financial impacts is in the area of lost revenues. And at this point in time, it's a guess. Our numbers are all guesses as to what they may be. And I'm not saying the guesses are wrong, but they are just that at this point. They are guesses because they're unknowns. We all clearly recognize that there are going to be decisions that have to be made by the governor and the legislature moving forward concerning the current state operating budget. All we would do is stress that we feel it's important for all of us to maintain a positive relationship between the state government and our 234 municipal governments. We're in this together, and to the extent that some federal emergency relief recovery funds may be used of assistance to our local governments, it would certainly be a benefit to our residents and taxpayers of our communities and state that we are all here to serve. And I appreciate the chance to be heard today.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Herman. Just a few quick notes for the advisory committee. We'll be asking you for any comments you might have for the presentations from the Municipal Association next. Please remember to hit 5-star to let us know if you have a question. For Ms. Burns at the NHMA, after the questions, we'll ask you if you have any brief, quick closing comments. And for the New Hampshire Association of Counties, we're going to get to you momentarily. Hopefully you're all still on the line. We have
Mr. Chair, but I had like 30 seconds as I was listening to the last speaker. This is Jim Donches.
30 seconds, sir.
Yes, health care costs. Manchester and Nashua, maybe other municipalities are self-insured. I know an individual now who's on a respirator now. You know, it's very tragic, but he's not a city employee. But if that begins to happen, the health care costs could escalate very rapidly. So if that begins to happen to city employees. So that's another area of concern. Anyway, thank you for the additional time.
Certainly. Thank you, Mayor Donches. So at this point in time, we have a request for a question from Representative Mary Jane Wallner.
Thank you. This is probably not really a question for any of our speakers, but just something I would like us to at some point have some discussion about. I've had some communication with communities who have helped set up the alternative care sites, and there are a lot of questions around the FEMA reimbursement and the 25% that they may end up being responsible for. So I would just like us to keep that someplace. Maybe we can put that in some people call it like the parking lot, and we could maybe talk with Mr. Plummer again about that funding and how that's going to work for our community.
Thank you, Representative Wallner. We've made a note of that. Further questions from the committee? Seeing and hearing none, Margaret Burns, do you have any summarizing comments from the Municipal Association?
Yes, thank you very much, Jerry, and members of the advisory board, and Representative Wallner's last comment that she made there. I would agree with you that that is a major area of concern. I've heard from the town of Hanover, and I'm sure there are other municipalities that are having that same issue with needing to front costs and pay significant costs for alternative care centers. And that conversation needs to happen to support them and figure out a better solution than what I am hearing is happening right now. So thank you for that comment. In summary, I think you have all heard about the expenses. You've heard about the serious concerns of revenue losses. And the bottom line for municipalities is that a portion of the $1.25 billion that is coming to this state to support COVID-19 financial impact must go to help support municipalities with what they're facing. The closing of small businesses and the local economies of municipalities are tied directly to local government. It is a fragile ecosystem, and they go hand in hand. And so those impacts are felt across the board. So thank you for hearing us. Thank you for indulging us and allowing us to go over our time. And thank you for all of the speakers who were here this morning.
Thank you very much, Margaret. So we will now move over to the Association of Counties. I assume that you're still on the phone with us. At this point in time, we had asked for about an hour presentation to hear from a county administrator, from county nursing homes, and from county corrections. Who is with us from the Association of Counties?
This is David Ross from Hillsborough County Nursing Homes.
This is Ray Bauer,
Superintendent Henry
county
from Carroll County Jail.
And Ray Bauer, County Administrator from Stratford County.
Mr. Administrator, why don't you go first for us, please?
Okay. If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, we actually had it. We have an order determined, so that way we're not wasting your time. So if
Perfect.
You wouldn't mind, the nursing home administrator would go first, and I think you'll find that we'll make up time for you.
Phenomenal. Thank you very much for that. Move ahead, please.
Good morning. My name is David Ross, and I'm the administrator of Hillsborough County Nursing Home, and I am here in my office alone in Goffstown, New Hampshire. Long-term care in the nursing homes, we are very concerned about the critical nature of this virus, understandably. There's been an increasing number of long-term care communities that are reporting positive cases and or outbreaks, and for us, patient and staff safety are our number one priorities. As a result, and following a multitude of regulatory guidance, all visitation in the facilities have ceased. There's no group activities, no group dining. Access to facilities is significantly limited to staff, authorized medical personnel, and with limited visitation at the end of life. we do active screening of all staff on every shift and any medical personnel that's entering the facility. We're screening them for any signs of virus or respiratory illness, and any positive screening whatsoever restricts their access to the facility. Staff have to go and get contact their medical provider to get screened or tested for COVID-19, and right now, testing results are coming to us in about 48 to 72 hours, which we're much appreciative of that because up until really this week, it was taking 7 to 14 days for someone to get testing results. So it was a very significant impact to facilities while folks were being screened out. All of our admissions are being tested now prior to leaving the hospitals to come into the facility for COVID-19. And although that is not a cure-all for preventing the entrance into a facility, it does give a sense of confidence at least that someone's not coming in presenting with active symptoms at that time. All facilities have had to create a 14-day monitoring unit for new admissions to isolate those new admissions from the general population while they may be have been infected in the hospital setting, and they have to allow for an incubation period. Additional PPE is required for all staff that are interacting with those patients because that's considered to be a presumptive positive period, and it's a significant drain on resources and a significant increased cost for us. All facilities have also been required to set up a unit for COVID-positive patients should they test positive within the facility so that you can manage them internally. That's a significant impact on the capacity within facilities. It certainly has lost revenue, but it's a significant impact for folks to try to remove patients and create new units and wings for that. Many facilities, as a result, have stopped admissions altogether to avoid any risk to their current population and to conserve that limited supply of protective equipment that they may have. Protective equipment, I'm sure you're well aware, consists of gloves, gowns, surgical masks, N95s, and face shields. All of these items are on allocation from contracted vendors. They've been on allocation for about 2 months now. So that means that we have a limited supply that we can get from our current vendors, so everyone has to go outside of the normal vendor market into the open market to be able to purchase these items. We are in direct competition with each other as well as with FEMA and every other organization that is trying to get these limited supplies. And as a result, we are seeing significant price gouging with markups, both in unit price, where we're seeing items priced 300 to 500% higher than we would normally pay, or also in the minimum order quantity that we actually have to receive. We've seen minimum order quantities when we may usually typically buy 10 cases of an item, that the minimum order quantity is 1,000 cases or 100,000 cases. Protective equipment, right now everybody in our facilities have to wear cloth masks at all time, as well as residents have to wear cloth masks while staff are providing care. Once you have a positive case in your facility, all of that has to switch to surgical masks, and all staff are now wearing face shields while they're in direct contact with any patient or whenever they enter a patient room. Those are all additional costs because no facility is prepared to have that type of supply internally at any given time. Just one positive patient in a facility changes everything because then all staff in the facility have to be wearing full PPE at all times in the facility, which does include gloves, gown, masks, and a face shield. And you have to change your gloves and gown in between each patient. For Hillsborough County Nursing Home alone, that would require us to have 60,000 gowns in a month, and that is following extended use guidelines as directed by CDC, where staff are reusing the same gown for each patient for an entire shift. For us, we requested 10,000 gowns from the state's emergency supply. We've received 100 gowns because they're just not available. Every facility is in that same spot. No one is out of PPE, and I think the Commissioner of Health and Human Services has made that point, but no one is really comfortable with their current level of inventory. And if anyone experiences an outbreak like some of the facilities have, it's a frightening place to be. Every facility is sharing what they have, so when a facility does go into outbreak, there is a network of facilities that are working together to be able to make sure that everyone is well taken care of. The COVID-19 has had a significant impact to staffing for facilities. but we had a workforce crisis before the pandemic even started. Increased use of telemedicine has been a significant drain on limited resources in the facility. Most of the facilities do not have all the technology limitation, the technology equipment to be able to support that, so it's required some additional purchases. It's required additional support to networks to be able to support that. But each of the providers that used to come to the facility to see patients now will just call and say, we'd like to do a telemedicine visit, and it requires significant staff support to be able to help our residents who can't always comprehend what is happening with this new technology, let alone navigating it independently. All of the licensed nursing assistants and nurse training programs have ceased. So work needs to be done with the Board of Nursing to be able to support recruitment and training of a new workforce. Screening of our employees at the beginning of each shift is really impactful to us. It removes staff weekly during the testing period. Hillsborough County Nursing Home, we range from 10 to 20 employees out every week for the full week due to COVID-related issues. That's either because they've had symptoms themselves, someone in their family has had symptoms, that they're high-risk employees, or they have family members who are high-risk. Some folks have just decided to take early retirement or go out on medical leave or just resign altogether. We are so grateful for the governor's long-term care stabilization program. It's exactly what we need to be able to help stabilize the workforce and encourage folks to come in, and we're working out the details to be able to help engage that program actively. We are very concerned once a facility does have a positive case within the facility because of the risk of transmission. We've all heard about asymptomatic transmission. In Washington State, a nursing home with 16 positive cases, they tested all of their patients and found that 57% were already asymptomatically positive. By the time symptoms present in one patient, the likelihood is that it's already widespread within the facility. And that goes back into the conversation about PPE, because when employees don't feel safe, they won't come to work. Following the extended use guidelines from the CDC to be able to stretch the use of PPE that we have doesn't feel safe to staff. It causes a lot of stress within the work environment. We're working very hard every day to help folks feel comfortable. There's the additional stress of having to put on and take off the protective equipment going in and out of everyone's room that adds so much work to their workday and so much stress as you're wearing a mask and shields and stuff that you're running on a good, on a normal day. Their staff are extremely busy and they're running very hard. When you're having to don and doff all of that equipment, it makes for a very high stress environment at a time when we can't get additional labor resources to be able to help support them. We also, when we had one positive employee test here a couple of weeks ago, that created additional stress for staff. In 2 days following the results of that positive staff member, we had 10 employees stop working. They were either fearful themselves, their family was afraid for them, folks got pulled out by their physician who wanted them to have testing. We have to do a lot of work with folks because of the angst that this creates. In addition to impacting our facilities, what we have seen is within the long-term care spectrum, which includes adult day centers, home health providers, and community-based providers. All of the adult day centers have closed, so folks that were normally getting services within their home don't have those services currently. Many of the adult day providers are doing phone check-ins with folks, assuming that they're able to actually answer the phone. Some of them are doing medication drop-offs at their home and providing some meal supports. CFI clients have been losing services and service providers to either limit access or because folks don't have adequate PPE to be able to provide support to them out in the community. And the same is for home health providers. Meals on Wheels has had significant impacts as well. They are doing drop-off services rather than check-in service. And they're now providing ready-to-eat meals or frozen meals for folks rather than putting their staff at risk working closely together in meal preparation activities and providing a hot meal. Many of the clients that they serve don't even have stoves or microwaves to be able to heat those. So they've had additional costs of having to purchase microwaves for clients so they can actually heat up the food that is coming to them. But for many of those folks that were in the community, their Meals on Wheels driver was the only contact that they would have all week long. The risk of social isolation is significant. primary practices have now closed, are limiting office hours only to either telehealth or for emergency care. So that has been a significant loss of a touchstone for folks to be able to do a check-in and make sure that they're okay. The state has identified that there's been a significant decrease in the reporting of elder abuse and mistreatment, and that provides significant risk for the population that we already knew was falling through the cracks. The lack of preventative and routine care support is only going to cause an increased use of emergency room visits for patients in crisis. And we know that emergency rooms are turning folks away that aren't presenting with COVID symptoms because they need to be able to keep that capacity available for those folks specifically. Unfortunately, all of the things that we've talked about prevent barriers for discharge from the hospital. The limitations on COVID testing, that the facilities are requiring more in COVID testing before admitting patients, the lack of community supports to be able to support people back in the community, and all of the admission and management requirements within the long-term care community, coupled with a very real and palpable fear of bringing a COVID-positive case into your facility, has encouraged many facilities just to close their doors and not take admissions. Hillsborough County, we have continued to take admissions. In the past week, we've had more than a dozen admissions, and we manage them actively to be able to help support the community and help reduce the capacity, the census of the hospitals. But it is a challenge, and it is a big drain on resources. And that's what I want to share with you today for the long-term care impact, and I'll let Jason Henry talk about corrections, unless there's any questions.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? If there are, if you would hit 5-star, they will show up on Rhonda's screen, and we will know to announce you. And just a bit of an aside, we're collecting a pretty good staff here at the Gopher office. With me is our new general counsel, Nancy Smith. And Nancy slipped me a note while you were speaking about price gouging and recommended, not sure what they might be able to do for you, but recommend that you report price gouging to the Consumer Protection Bureau of the New Hampshire Department of Justice. I'm going to give you phone numbers. 1-888-468-4454 or 603-271-3641. And the email would be doj-cpb@doj.nh.gov. Was that a hyphen or is that an underscore?
No, it's a hyphen.
It's a hyphen. Thank you very much. So thank you for that. And we do have a question from Senator Lou D'Alessandro. Senator D'Alessandro. You may be on mute, Senator D'Alessandro.
Have you got me now?
Have you now, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. I think that there are two things. The testing question has occurred right across the board, and the fact that we are having problems with that, either we don't have enough testing kits or the fact of the matter is we didn't test enough people. That's a concern. The second is the price gouging. That's awful, and indeed what that does is it just skyrockets costs, and people don't get the kinds of things that they need. Again, I've heard that repeatedly, and when you said the percentages of increase, that's quite astounding. That people would obviously take advantage of a situation like this. As Jerry points out, we have a mechanism to deal with that. It just seems to be that that's got to be a priority item. A, if you have price gouging, you're not getting it because people are holding out for more money. That to me is an unbelievable situation. Got to be.
It's very untenable.
Yeah, I mean, look at the money we're wasting based on that situation. That's it. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator. Unless there are other questions, I believe your next speaker is representing the correctional segment.
Good afternoon. This is Superintendent Jason Henry of Carroll County Jail. I'm currently in my office in Ossipee alone, if you can all hear me.
Yeah. We hear you.
Okay, just want to make sure. Thank you, Advisory Board, for taking the time to, again, listen to us today. Jails are uniquely different than most places, so I will go over some of the things that we are currently experiencing. Most of the jails, for all of them, have closed down visits to and most of our volunteers as well, and really limiting who can come inside of our facilities, which, as you can imagine, is very stressful for our offenders that are inside. We still allow legal visits, usually through glass if we can, or phones, if a facility has it or the facility has the ability for video capabilities. And each jail is a little different. Some of us can, some of us cannot. Most of us are doing screenings for staff on the way in to make sure that they don't show any signs, fever, those sorts of things. And on our intakes, we can't shut down as a jail. We still have to take those that are arrested. We still have to take them in. It has slowed down, but with that being said, we're still seeing plenty of them come through the door. We're still seeing people that like to fight, spit, people that are on drugs, mentally ill. So we're still dealing with that on a daily basis of those type of issues, which is putting us in close contact with new arrivals. We have some limited PPE for most of the jails, but we're usually on the lower food chain, so we are very much struggling for PPEs. Inside of the jails, significant increase in our cost for cleaning supplies, as we are constantly going through over and over again as our inmates live in close quarters to each other. All of us have had to rearrange our facilities to designate quarantine areas. The people do stay here. We also have to have them quarantined for 14 days and keep an eye on them. And then hopefully from there, we're able to move to general population. Other things are difficult. Depending on your jail, like mine, I do not have 24-hour care for nursing staff. I have 3 full-time nurses for 7 days a week. That makes it difficult. If one of my nurses goes down, I'm going to be very much in trouble. Some of the other jails have a larger staff. And they may experience, it may take them a little longer before they feel that pinch, but it is going to be devastating to us. Some of us rely on food from the nursing homes for our inmates, like here. If the nursing home in Carroll County were to go down, or in Belknap County, we don't know exactly where we would get the meals for our offenders inside here. With restaurants and everything else being closed, it's hard to make partnerships as an alternative planning. We are under a lot of stress from outside agencies like the ACLU, public defenders, to release as many offenders as we can. And we have done so, trying to make it as safe as possible for those that we can let out. With that, even when we take the best measures to put who we think are the proper people out, I will relay one quick story. I personally put somebody out we thought would do okay, and a week later, she overdosed and have you taken to the hospital. She survived and is now back here with us. There is not a lot of support out in the community for them. It is hard to continue a case management plan. There is not a lot of places for them to go for shelter, food, or even follow up with their doctors. So it's not just as easy as just saying, let's open the doors and let them go back out to the community. We have also seen, and Ray Bauer talked to afterwards, loss of revenues for the jails, which are going to have a significant impact on the county's budgets. Rockingham County, when I spoke to them this morning, they're very concerned because next door to them, Middlesex County Jail, has had positive cases. And Rockingham County Jail, a lot of the inmates that go back and forth are right across that border right there. And with them, they have about a week's worth of supply of personal protection gear in Rockingham County Jail. What will happen if it gets inside of there? We have staff that are on the front lines. They're going through mental and physical fatigue. We were also, in the corrections world,
having difficulty in hiring staff. Most of your jails are down in staffing. We are hoping that the state and the federal government will look at some sort of stipend for first responders so that they can continue coming to work. They are, again, trying to get with lack of our PPEs. We're using cloth masks that we can. We're cleaning where we can. And then when they go home, they still take off all of their gear before they can go meet up with their loved ones. And I'm asking them to come back to work on a daily basis where there can be a fight on the unit, intakes. So there's a lot of exposure going on that makes things very difficult. With that, that's pretty much where we're at. We really need PPEs and an incentive for our first responders. And at the end of this, we're going to be a financial impact of cleaning supplies and overtime is going to be, right now, it'll be very expensive throughout the jails. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Superintendent Henry. Are there any questions for Mr. Henry? If so, please hit 5-star. And Mr. Bauer, we will be to you in just a second as we confirm. There are no questions, so County Administrator Bauer.
Thank you, and thank you for the committee's time. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. I just want to echo the PPE requirements with a little different angle. I believe that there's quite a bit of PPE that does exist in New Hampshire. The problem is it's being reserved for those places that have an outbreak. And while I understand that to be significant, I think it needs to be balanced by distributing it to places that don't have outbreaks so that those places can prevent outbreaks. It seems a little foolish for holding the PPE to be given to a place that has an outbreak and not a balance in prevention, which would certainly, in the long run, save PPE. So I'm hoping that that can be considered in the process. There is going to be lost revenue for a number of county departments, as Superintendent Henry mentioned, and the Association of Counties is in the process of putting together a six-month projection going back to the date that the governor set in March, and we'll have that information available. Right now it's at its infancy in the sense that we're not seeing any real impacts as our facilities have been able to delay or, if we're lucky, cancel any direct impact from COVID. And I did also want to repeat the thought for a hazardous duty stipend, not only for the correctional staff, but for our sheriff's department, who is integrally involved in jail operations in all of the counties. One last thing I'd like to mention, and hopefully we've been short enough to get you, your committee, a little bit closer to on track for timing, and that is the likelihood that in nursing homes and in the House of Correction, there's going to be a much longer impact than there is likely to be in the community. So as community sanctions someday begin to be lifted, I think it's important for the committee to know that there's likely to be a continued impact, particularly in the nursing homes because of the frailty of our populations, that we're going to need some assistance for much longer than what would be available in the generally more healthy communities. And that's all I have, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, sir. Are there any questions from the Legislative Advisory Board for any of the speakers from the representing the counties of the state? I don't see any. And that does
Just the inquiry. I was just wondering if we got a gold star or something for the fact that we were brief. If so, we'd appreciate any consideration for that.
Two gold stars for all three of you.
Thank you very much. We'll split them up between the three of us. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Perfect. We don't see that we have any requests for questions, so apparently that completes our presentations for the morning. However, members of the advisory board, I want to point out that there's one more section of your agenda, item F, which is open business items. I'm going to take them out of order. The Senator D'Alessandro, at the end of our last meeting, you requested an update from the governor's office on other COVID-related expenses that have been made to date. You all should have received an email this morning with a document in it, which is a list of all of the COVID response related programs and expenses that had been made to date. Did you receive that document, and do you have any questions about it?
Yes, we received the document.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Well, if you do have any questions about that document, feel free to reach out to the governor's office or the governor's staff, or you may contact me and we can forward a message to you, which brings us to the final item on your agenda, which is the tabled motion to vote on a chairperson. The way that we identify...
Terry, before we go there, I just wanted to point out something that came up in several of the presentations. And I think it's much more legislative than it was our committee. I don't know how Ways and Means in both the House and the Senate meet to look, you know, to publicly look at revenues, but it's pretty obvious that a lot of these groups are nervous about, you know, what they're going to receive from rooms and meals and everything else. So I would think we have the ability to do some kind of calculating and publicly figure out, you know, what might be held back and what's not going to be held back. I don't think that would happen with this group, but I think it needs to be done because any shortfalls there will hit this group. So.
Understood. So essentially a message to your fellow lawmakers that maybe we'd like to get Ways and Means together to provide the counties and the municipalities with a midpoint update on revenues and what they might be able to expect. Is that correct, sir?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, yes on revenues, and then part of it is that the finance chairs deal with that. I mean, I didn't anticipate anything that was set today would be things that would be looked at and being cut, to be honest with you. But I'm sure we can look at that. I mean, it just seems like some of that's common sense. Yeah. But anyhow, I'm just bringing it up because I think it's not this committee, you know, what we should be doing. So.
I think your club, it's Jerry, I think Senator Morris's club, it's a well-taken because throughout every one of these presentations, loss of revenue from the state has been articulated. And it has to deal, obviously, with rooms and meals money coming back, municipal aid coming back, the registrations, et cetera. So revenue, lost revenue pervasive throughout all of our conversations. Testing, another very significant fact in the amount of testing that we're not doing, the amount of testing that we should be doing, has again been pervasive throughout all of these presentations. I've been told with the extension of the payment of taxes to June, getting a handle on revenue is going to be fairly difficult at this point in time. We can do a lot of estimates and projections, but with the date extended to June, the actual payments aren't going to take place, or they have that length of time before they make payments. and focusing on on rooms, the rooms and meals because of its impact on Manchester, having to do with the payment what used to be the Verizon Center. Those are very important issues. And the last thing I'd like to say is this price gouging. That to me is terrible. And if that is pervasive, particularly with the nursing homes and the other publicly operated facilities competing against one another, that's something that has to be addressed. We have a mechanism for doing that, but I think it has to be done very, very quickly. That can't continue. That's going to drive these costs through the roof.
Thank you, Senator D'Alessandro. We also had you down as requesting a question. Does this period of time cover that, or do you have another question, sir?
No, I think that covers that covers the situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator D'Alessandro. We have a request for a question from Representative Mary Jane Wallner.
Thank you, Jay. Last week, or at fiscal committee, we were given an informational item by the Department of Health and Human Services about transfers from different programs into COVID-related items, which we now have sort of a breakdown here about them. One item that was not included, as I remember, on the transfer was the substance disorder rate increase. And I wondered if anyone there or if you could just get me some information about that. Had that rate increase not been given yet, or because that was a transfer out of substance use disorder rate increase of $8 million. And I was wondering how that actually works. That was my question.
Thank you, Representative Wallner. So if I can restate it to make sure that I understand, your question is whether or not the rate increase for substance abuse service providers has, in fact, happened at this point in time. If not, what's the process?
Yes, thank you. Yes. And it may be that someone, we'll have to get that information, and you can give it to me at a later date, but if no one has it right now. Thank you.
I don't think we have it right now, but we'll see if we can get you an answer, ma'am.
Thank you.
And finally, I have a request from Senate President Susie for a question.
Thank you, Commissioner Little. Two things. One, I did want to acknowledge the comments of Senator Morse. I do believe the Speaker and I are going to be meeting with staff about committees starting to resume, and certainly reviewing revenues is a very important aspect of what needs to be done. But my question was regarding the handout that was sent from the governor's office regarding funds that had been spent so far. In particular, I was wondering if we could get some additional information about the hospital fund. I see from this document that $14 million has been allocated. I wondered if we could get a breakdown of the entities that money has been allocated to, also how many applications for that fund are still pending, and what is the process, what is the evaluation process, and who's conducting that at this point?
Okay. Hi, Senator. This is Max Zellum. That information will be posted and available later today regarding which entities have received and the process and who has reviewed.
Max, when you're posting, is that grants or is that loans?
They are loans. They are loans with the possibility. They are forgivable loans, but they are loans.
Okay.
Very good. Rhonda, do we have any more question requests on your screen?
No other questions, sir.
We have no other requests for questions. I'll always take one right here on the phone if something comes to you. We've gone through the second item under business, other business, Governor Sununu's COVID expense report. The final thing is leftover business from our last meeting, which is to discuss a chairperson. As I mentioned last week, the role of the chairperson is to be the collection point for requests, questions you have for us here, or directions you want to give us as to what you think you'd like to see happen through the Gopher. Would you mind having another conversation about that at this point in time? Any thoughts or ideas?
Jerry, this is Dick Hinch. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. So I had made a motion to nominate Senator Morse, which was seconded by Representative Hennessy, and that motion was tabled, but that is the pending motion. So I'd like to resurface that motion and once again nominate Senator Morse to be the chairperson.
So I'll accept that as a motion to take the tabled item off the table. Is there a second?
I'll second the motion.
Motion is moved and seconded. I guess legally I am required to run through the roll call since we're doing a conference call. Senate President Susi?
Yes.
Speaker Shurtleff?
Steve Shurtleff, yes.
Leader Chuck Morse?
Yes.
Leader Dick Hinch?
Yes.
Chairman Lou D'Alessandro?
Yes.
Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner?
Yes.
Senator John Reagan?
Yes.
Representative Aaron Hennessy?
Yes.
That motion passes. It's off the table. So the original motion stands and was seconded to nominate Senate Leader Chuck Morse as chairman of the Legislative Advisory Board. Any discussion?
Well, if I could just make a comment, I don't have any problem with Senator Morse being chairman of the board. It just seems to me we're creating another step. We'll now go to the chairman, who will then go to you. And indeed, it seems to be the direct step of going directly to you as the governor's appointee to manage this situation is a more efficient and effective way to do it. Chuck will do a great job of doing whatever we want him to do, and if because of the executive order we have to do this, I don't have any problem with it. I think it just creates another step. It kind of creates a little bit of bureaucracy where we don't need it, and I think this has worked very effectively the way you have handled it up to this point. We've gotten the persons that we want to talk to. The structure has been well done. It's been very well managed. That to me seems to be a good way to go. But I will defer to anything that the committee wants. And as I say, great support for Senator Morse. He's a wonderful legislator and a great friend and has been a very effective leader. So whatever you want, I just want to point out that we're creating bureaucracy where we don't have to.
Thank you, Senator. As I understand the direction that I've received from the governor, what he is hoping is that, or what we're concerned about is that with 8 members of this committee, we could get orders to the Gopher from 8 separate members of the committee to point us in 8 different directions. And so we're hoping that the role of the chairman will be to collect those requests and wishes of the committee and point us in one direction. When you have agreed as to what it is you want us to do. So I see it more as facilitating the process rather than making it more difficult. At least that's the intent.
As I said, Jerry, I don't have any problem. I just pointed out that I think we have a very efficient and effective mechanism in place. Whatever the committee wants to do, I'm in sync with it. I just point out something that I think is worth mentioning.
Thank you, sir. Are there any other comments?
Jerry, I move to close the nominations and call the question. Is it Dick Hinch?
Very good. Thank you. Then I will call a roll on the motion to nominate Leader Chuck Morris as Chairman of the Legislative Advisory Board. President Soucy?
Yeah.
Speaker Shurtleff?
Yes.
Leader Morris?
Yes.
Leader Hinch?
Yes.
Chairman D'Alessandro?
Yes.
Chairwoman Wallner?
Yes.
Senator Reagan?
Yes.
And Representative Hennessy?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you very much. Congratulations, I think, Senator Morris. I just have a couple other things. I want to confirm for you that our next meetings are set for Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of next week. I believe all of them are set for 1 p.m. Is everyone okay with that?
Yes.
That's fine.
Yes. Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
Jerry, the only thing I'd point out, because I jumped on your call yesterday, if the other group is looking at things that we're not looking at, we should probably make, you know, and if that's going to be on Tuesday and Thursday, I guess, because you're running out of time yourself, maybe you should just make us aware of what they're listening to. You know, I know we can't speak on those calls, but we can certainly, if they're listening to different groups, we could hear it. If everyone doesn't know, there's another whole group of, like, business-type people that are doing what we're doing. I listened to them yesterday afternoon, so. And I thought Jerry did a good job of leading them and telling them that we were studying certain things that it really didn't make sense to do today. So.
Thank you, Senator Morris. What Senator Morris is referring to is the Stakeholders Advisory Committee, which is a group of folks representing a broad spectrum of other segments of New Hampshire, both social and economic areas. I don't have the list right in front of me, but I believe, is it on the website, Rhonda, the list of the folks that are on there's a press release on the governor's website under the Gopher page where you can see who's on that. They raised the same question yesterday. Are we plowing the same ground as the other committee? And the answer at times is absolutely yes. We will do our best to coordinate two groups. In fact, the governor's executive order tells us to try to do so to avoid overlap. That may not be entirely possible because each has asked us to cover certain items. We will point out when this has been addressed by one or the other. The other, to the extent that there is an upside to talking to the same people, if we get the same thoughts and recommendations from both the Legislative Advisory Committee and the Stakeholders Advisory Committee, we can probably accept that that's a great recommendation if it comes from both directions. But we will try to facilitate those so you don't plow the same ground. On Monday, so what we have done at the Gopher office for you is to try to set out draft agendas for each of the upcoming 3 days. And in broad terms, we'd like to suggest that on Monday, we focus on health care. On Wednesday, we focus on hospitality and business. And on Friday, we address education and nonprofits, and in each of those instances, we will try to schedule things to keep these calls to 2 hours if possible.
Good.
I underscored try. Going to do our best.
Jerry, Steve Shurtleff, I've got a question for you.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, can the legislature seek reimbursement through CARES funding because of the extraordinary costs we've had in sanitizing the State House, the LLB, costs for remote conference meetings, things of that nature? I know the sanitation of the State House in LOB, it was close to $45,000, so.
Yeah, it's a very good question, Mr. Speaker. Unfortunately, we still do not have the guidance from Treasury, U.S. Treasury, as to how we use the fund. But when we do, we'll take a look at that.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate it.
Your CEO, Mr. Foth, will remind me if we forget to do that.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? In particular, do those general groupings for topics on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday next week make sense to you?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, we will try to work with the Stakeholders Advisory Group who are looking at some of the same issues to make sure that we don't do a double hit on some of those same topics, and we will send you draft agendas as soon as we have them prepared. Anything else for the good of the order? Hearing none, then we will declare this meeting of the Legislative Advisory Board adjourned at 12:27 p.m. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks.
Thank you.